This is the light relief at the end of a hard couple of days' work. However, illustrations are going to be lighter relief than that, because I don't have a coherent theory of illustrations, nor can I work one out. And if you don't have a coherent theory of something, it's impossible to give a talk that has any coherence in it as well. So I'm not going to try and do that, because what I've got is 100 different ideas about illustrations, and possibly more like 1,000 of them, as you just come across individual illustrations and you say, that doesn't work because, and there's another theory about it that you didn't realise before. And every time you see an illustration not working, or every time you see an illustration working, you learn something more about illustrations. And so I'm not quite sure how you can actually hold it all together. I am for illustrations for lots of reasons, but not the least, in case it's necessary, because the Bible uses them. Each of the Bible preachers use illustrations of different kinds and varied natures, some of them physical, visual aid, so to speak, some of them just words here or there, some of them parables, some of them, but the Bible uses them. So I don't have a problem in the fact that we use them. There's good precedent. But I thought we should discuss together, and therefore I'm hoping that your minds are still in gear, that you can contribute to this for me. And I'll play off the ideas that you throw out and throw in a few myself on what is an illustration, why we use illustrations, what do we want to achieve with illustrations, what are the consequences, both positive and negative, in our illustrations, and isn't it time to go home? In that order, roughly. You might like to try the first one last, but the last will not be first. So, what do you think are illustrations? What do you mean by the word illustration? What is an illustration? It's not as dumb a question as it first sounds. Yeah, so it's the move from the abstract to the concrete. It's the concrete concrete expression of an abstract idea. Something like that, yeah. The move from the known to the unknown. Yep. It's a basic principle of education, from the known to the unknown. He wants to go from the known to the unknown. You want to go from the unknown to the known. Well, I understand his. I understand Lionel's. You're going to have to explain yours to me. That is a basic principle of education, wherever possible, is you want to move people to something they don't know. You talk about something they do know, which will help them understand what they don't know. That one I understand. What's your one? Oh, I see. It's, again, the idea of moving from abstract to concrete. They don't understand. They don't know what the abstract is. You tell them what it is, but they don't know what it means. You then go to something. No, it's the same thing. Yep, different usage of the word, but the same idea. But that educationally, you are building out of what people know into what they don't know. An abstract, they can't understand, so you give them the concrete which enables them to reach to that. Yes. Good. Yep, you're appreciating the audience. You're showing them that you understand they're struggling with the ideas and that you're trying to help them with the ideas you're saying, yes? So it unites you to an audience. What particular kind of illustration unites you to an audience? Sorry? My failure, yes. Oh, no, generally people's failure, yes. Yes. A common experience, yes. Yeah, the commonality of our life together, yeah. Commonality of life that they have, you may not have with them, but you can actually identify it with them. Yes? Common reactions. Which reaction in particular? Laughter, humour. Yes, humour is one of the big uniters, right? Because it shows what kind of person you are, shows you do not take yourself too seriously, shows that you enjoy a psychological health, because people who don't have a sense of humour are, you know, psychologically questionable. It's important that you have a sense of, at this moment now there are people sitting there very straight faced. We are worried about you. I have your name. It is all right. You see, all that helps in terms of identifying person, connecting in. If you can laugh together at the same thing, you have a common emotional experience. And so one of the ones you mentioned at the first up was emotional. Laughter is the easiest, most straightforward one. But tears, crying, can also have profound effect in uniting the audience to the speaker. Any of the common emotions that you can connect with, connects you as people, audience and speaker. Laughter's the easiest, simplest one. Yeah? What other ones can you do to unite? Outrage you could do too, yes. You actually say something that is just so awful that the audience has the same emotional reaction response, as was mentioned, as the speaker would have. Yeah? Yes, a shared embarrassment. Yes, and that's why failure works too, for the same kind of reason, isn't it? Because everybody has been in the failure situation, everybody has been embarrassed, and you can feel with the other person when they can identify. And of course, often these things run together, don't they? Failure, embarrassment, humour is a classic way. Chapo's enormous sense of humour, 50% or more of the jokes are about the mistakes he's made in life, about things he did wrong, about goofing off one way or another. And that makes him such a funny man because he's had more than his fair share of failures in life. There is an endless supply of humour, you see. And so we can connect as people once we start laughing with each other and laughing with each other about ourselves. Because as he laughs about him, and as you laugh about him, you're actually laughing about yourself, aren't you? Because you can see yourself in the same situation or a similar situation or with a similar response. So a very important part of illustration is just this connectedness between the speaker and the audience. Okay? But what is an illustration? That moves to why. What is an illustration? It's connecting with the audience. Okay? But what is it? Well, so far the one we've got is a what really is a concrete for an abstract idea. Yeah? So it's a particularity of the general, which may not itself be an abstract. Yeah. And here's a particular instance when this could be the case. Yes? Is this a comment about John Stott's forms of illustrations? Being the great bird watcher that he is. Yes. All right. So there are examples of the idea. Yeah? No, so you could... No. This is a free-ranging discussion just to get us thinking. So we're not actually going to come out with the final definitive word on what the meanings of words are. Yeah, applications can be illustrations. Illustrate. You can't differentiate them sometimes, can you? But you should not steal. There is a picture of scripture. And so therefore you come to some applications. And so you can say, well, what are you doing about the copying CDs, the music? What are you doing about pirating Matthias Media Bible studies? What are you doing about copying programs and downloading programs rather than paying for them? Here are applications of stealing, which are illustrations of stealing at the same time, aren't they? Yes, an illustration is a method of trying to better explain something. Yep. That's right, which may be a general, may be an abstract, may be a complex, might be an unknown, but the illustration is a didactic methodology. It's a teaching methodology. It's not, that's why I haven't got a coherent theory on it, because it's not actually something taught in the Bible. It's actually about teaching. So it's how we teach, really. Yes. Now, how short or how quick can an illustration be? A simile is an illustration, isn't it? A metaphor can be an illustration, but a simile is. That is, illustrations have to do with the fact of the way of people think. And we think analogically. We think by analogues. We think of parallel ideas. And so in our language, we keep using similes. That things are like this, and things are like that, and just as, and just like. And that's a way to help us to think about what we're trying to think about. And so an illustration actually can be just a couple of words, can't it? Like a cat vomiting. No, it's just a couple of words. But it can illustrate something. Well, the New Testament does it, like a dog returning to its vomit. In 2 Peter 2, right? Like a dog returning to its vomit. It's only just a few words, right? God is described in one part of the Bible as a drunk. It's in the book of Psalms. As a drunk has trouble waking in the morning. So God. And it's important to do that because every now and then people will say, but God is likened to a woman, and therefore we must use female language of God. Well, God is likened to a drunk as well, and therefore we must use alcoholic language of God. I mean, it doesn't really follow that way. It's a misunderstanding of the nature of similes and the nature of... But they're used there very quick. Yes. So to go to the other, you can have a very quick liker, but you can also have a whole story, can't you? You can have Pilgrim's Progress, the whole volume, which is a massive illustration of great Christian truths on the way that we go through life and heaven. So you can make them very short or very long, and they're still achieving the same function. What is the normal kind of illustration of the things we're talking of that you think of in the Bible? Parables. Now, why does Jesus teach parables? So as to judge the disciples. Yes. Parables are confrontation. That's the reason for illustration at that point. It's not to make it simple. It's not to make it easy. If anything, it's to keep it obscure. But it's to keep it obscure in a way that confronts you and challenges you to step further in or to go away not understanding. And so there are illustrations which are puzzles, which are riddles, that try and force people to be thinking through issues. And so sometimes you can use illustrations. So I mean, you're thinking preacher, don't think preacher, I'm thinking speaker, I'm thinking teacher, I'm thinking a teacher of the Bible. There are times at which what you need to be doing is to be asking the question. The question is an illustration. What do we do in the situation? And then you give it. And it's a puzzle that you want people to be thinking through so as to help them understand the importance of what the Bible is saying. And so the illustration can come in the puzzle form. And remember, the parables can be quite long or they can be very short. What enters a man? It's not what enters a man that defiles him, but that which comes out of his heart that defiles him. There is a sentence which is in Mark chapter 7, which Mark chapter 7 calls a parable. I don't think the translations do in English, but the Greek does. It's a parable. What was the meaning of this parable? But it's just a little sentence, which we would almost call an illustration, an idea, an analogy. So illustrations can be a great variety of things, can't they? What else can they be? Let's push it even further. They can be verbal fixtures, can't they? Yes. You see, there are lots of people who think visually. There are other people who do not think visually. So sometimes I understand if we ask you to kind of close your eyes, which I'm not going to do, but you ask you to close your eyes and think about the Harbour Bridge, some of you will think about it propositionally and some of you will actually have it drawn in your mind and will be thinking of the shape of the coat hanger. How I can test this theory, I don't know, except for subjectively in terms of you telling us what you were thinking of later. But there are some people who think visually, and there are others who think propositionally. And so some people are really helped when the preacher can just, you know, put some illustration on the light, on the board. That helps somehow. There are other people who think, that doesn't do anything for me. That's of no help whatsoever in the way in which I can understand what is taking place. But that is part of illustration, isn't it? Right? So it can be just visual illustrations which are important. Learning how people think is important. There are all kinds of differences. I was chatting to a man earlier today who said about another man that he understands things by getting piece by piece by piece and putting the puzzle together. Whereas the man I was talking to says no, that he actually gets the whole big picture first and then goes and puts the little pieces in. And there are two different ways of thinking in this room that are just exactly like that. But some of us, until we've got the big picture, we don't know what to do with the individual pieces. And there are others of us who really don't trust the big picture until we've made sure we've got each of the little pieces in order. Now, when you're speaking to two different kinds of people, plus the visual ones, three different kinds of people. And so you need different kinds of illustrations to connect with the different kinds of learning styles that people have. That's to say nothing of the ones who are still in their childhood and learn kinesthetically. So they only learn if you go 1, 2, 3, 4. What are the 4 points? All hand out there together. 1, 2, 3. There's some TV evangelists I've seen who are now going into the kinesthetic kind of learning. And so, you know, every sermon has 4 points of first point, second point, third point, fourth point. You know, and so the whole congregation is doing this together so as to get their exercise at the same time. And it means that when they're out in the street evangelising the people, they say, well, that's a third point, you know. And, oh, I think really it's fourth point at this point. But there are those who learn it. I get irritated as an adult when people treat me like a child in their singing periods, and they want me to stand up and jump down and wriggle around and clap my hands because, I mean, I enjoyed it when I was 8. I find it fairly offensive, you know, at my stage and phase of life when it's imposed upon me. But there are some people who have never grown up, and for them that is the way in which they learn, and therefore we've got to actually cater for them in another room in another church somewhere else. So there can be just the sheer break of concentration, as was mentioned right at the beginning, but there can be a break in the way in which we think. And so you can follow the logic for just so long, and after a while, some of us start dropping off that kind of linear logical procession of ideas, and for whom, therefore, a little story now is going to help us have a kind of mental break when we can then return back to the ideas that are going. Yes? It may be part of the logic, but it needn't be. Sometimes people put a joke in just so as to give everyone a break, and then off we go, especially if you're talking long talks. So in my analysis of Billy Graham's preaching, he would start off with a polite, deferential, American kind of over-the-top flattery of the audience. Right? So I'm really glad to be here in Sydney. It's the most beautiful city I've ever seen. That harbour is breathtaking, and you are the luckiest people in all the earth. Right? So we all feel good about ourselves. Then second step is he would tell a joke. It was a funny thing happened to me on the way to the stadium tonight, and then he'll tell his standard joke, which gets us all laughing at him and the universe and everything else. And now I'm going to speak on the family tonight. It's a very important topic. And then he would give 8 5-minute talks, and at the end of each one, he would tell a little joke or a story that had nothing to do with the talk on either side. Right? And so you actually just got 8 5-minute gobbets in a 40-minute talk, separated by little mind breaks that may or may not connect in to the family or to the talk or to anything else that's happening, and then have the standard appeal at the end, irrespective of what he said on the way through. Now, you've got to pay attention. I mean, he's the greatest preacher of the 20th century. In terms of holding crowds and attention and keeping them in, whatever else, Billy Graham was breathtakingly brilliant as an orator. Whatever else. I think he's been very, very great man in terms of other things too. His faithfulness and integrity and his consistency in gospel has been wonderful. But leaving all that aside for a moment, you know, if he was a politician, you'd still have to say he was one of the great orators of all time. And that was his method in mass communication. We're talking how to preach to 30, 40, 50, 60, 70,000 people from all walks and phases of life, and keep the audience in attention. The other trick he had, I noticed, was he spoke with enormous speed. Incredible speed. He was very, very fast. And you really, you had to keep listening because he had this urgency that kept on pouring forward at enormous speeds. And then he'd stop and have a big break. Then off he'd go again. And so there is a pattern. But his was just mind breaks as far as I could see. And I don't think he could concentrate for more than 5 minutes, and he never thought the audience could. Hey, at last, you are the illustration. Yes, that is right. Yes, yes. We are walking, talking illustrations. That is why the itinerant has to give you so many illustrations at the first, and why he has to crack all the jokes, because he has no rapport with the audience. Whereas the regular weekly preacher does not have to do that, because they've already got all the persona worked out in that kind of regard, and it's because we are our own illustrations. You illustrate what you're saying by the clothes you're wearing, by where you stand, whether you're standing behind a pulpit or whether you stand away from the pulpit, whether you drink water or you don't, whether you crack jokes or you don't, you speak fast, you use your hands, it's all part of the illustrations. That is, preaching is kind of an incarnational activity, so to speak. It's not just... That's why you can't... See, what is the problem with stealing other people's sermons? Well, I've called stealing, therefore immediate. What's the problem with just reading other people's sermons? In one sense, there's not, because after all, it's perfectly right. It's a very ancient tradition. The Reformed Church do it. The Anglican Church have a book of sermons called the Homilies, which are to be read out if you haven't got a sermon to preach. Nothing wrong with reading somebody else's sermons out. That's perfectly an appropriate thing to do. What's wrong with it? Well, it's because the pastor is more than just a sermon preacher. The pastor is the shepherd who is modelling the sermon they're preaching. And it's important that the congregation sees our growth in life and doctrine. And we are actually walking ahead of the sheep, showing them the way to go. And I can't do that by just reciting Billy Graham's sermons for you. That is not what I'm not showing you anything about me when I'm reading somebody else's sermon. The only thing I'm showing you is my selectivity of sermon and how well I do or don't read. But it's not... And whereas the whole sermon, the whole activity of being the Bible study group leader is to model what you are saying. And so it's do as I say and do as I do, because what I do is part of what I say. How I treat the audience, how I treat the subject matter, the integrity with which I argue or the lack of integrity with which I argue, the manipulative processes that are used, that's all part of the message that is being preached. You can't, in the end, separate it all out. It all matters. So under illustrations, you see, you can pretty well say almost everything, can't you? Because a lot of your Bible teaching can be illustrations too, can't it? Because some of the very best illustrations are when you pull out of the life of David something that is illustrating the point that Paul is making, or you pull out of the life of Moses something that... Or you pick up some of the book of Proverbs and use them as the illustrations of the point you want to make. It's all illustrations. So, however, once you get a definition of something that's everything, then it's nothing. So just think back to a simpler idea about what an illustration is and say to me, well, what are the advantages of illustrations? We've already said some of the advantages of it. It's to communicate, it's to connect with the audience, it's to make things knowable and understandable and simple, it's to confront people. It's to bring the subject matter into the real world so that you're not dealing with fairyland kind of substance. It's to show the implications of what is said into the lives of the people to whom you are speaking. What are the other ones there? I've rattled out ones that were already mentioned. Yes, memorable. Memorability comes in illustrations. Thank you. Yep. Yes. Yes, they do. It changes the dynamic of listening in terms of receptivity. Yes. Mm-hmm. In other words, let their guard down. Mm-hmm. Yes, it does reinforces the point. Yes. I mean, one of the great theories is that you state the point, you restate the point in synonyms, you illustrate the biblical basis for the point, then you illustrate what the point means from outside the Bible, then you restate the point. There is a teaching kind of method of making sure the information is conveyed to people. Yeah? Yes. In fact, you tailor it to what the audience needs to hear, but you also tailor the audience to whom you want to be there by your illustrations. That is, if you're a young person preaching to an old congregation, do not illustrate your talks from anything to do with school. Because as soon as you start talking about school, it reinforces that you're a young person who hasn't got the right to be leading an older congregation. But if you're a young person speaking to a younger congregation, well, then illustrate it from school days. Because that is something they can relate to, and that's something that connects you with them. You've been to school like they've been to school, and so you can talk about their common experience. So in the one talk, you will use two different illustrations depending on the audience. That being the case, if you keep preaching in the same spot all the time, the kinds of illustrations you use will self-select the audience. The audience, you see, will come and say, oh, yeah, I like that man, he's talking to me. Or, I don't like that man, he's got nothing to do with me. Now, where do they make that judgment about you? They make that judgment in the illustrations you use. in the choice of the illustrations, in the manner in which you are preaching. That's where they make those judgments. And the man who makes no illustrations, they say, oh, he's a cold fish. You know, I mean, what he says is true enough, but I just don't relate to him at all. Now, of course, in some ways, the best illustrations are the multi-purpose illustrations, the ones that any person can relate to. And the best itinerants are people like Chapo, who seem to be interested in everything and anything, and within one talk can be talking about classical music and the ballet, and can be talking about rugby league, and can be talking about gardening, and can be talking about politics. And so whoever you are, you can feel like he's in touch with my life. But if you're someone who never talks about classical music and ballet, well, there's a whole section of the community who will feel you actually don't know their world. You don't understand them. You're not part of their universe, because that's where they live. And if all your illustrations are out of rugby league, well, you'll be very good in certain parts of Sydney, but not much good in Melbourne. You know, it's a very select group that you'll be relating to down there. An old clergyman and friend of mine that I worked for as a catechist many years ago, he said this: you only need to know three or four things in Australia and you can talk to anyone. This is not just preaching, it's just in terms of conversations with people. So if you can talk about children, gardening, sport, politics, you can talk to anyone in Australia. And there's a certain truth in that. There's not many people who aren't connected somewhere along those four kinds of subjects. I think one that's working very well these days with people is movies. In your generation especially. You can talk movies, you can talk to most people, because most people spend a lot of time knowing about what's happening in movies. And from movies you can make illustrations on almost anything, can't you? The trouble is, of course, with movies, as soon as you use the illustration from a movie, you're talking the language of the people, but there's a good chance that half the audience hasn't seen that particular movie. So sometimes by the time you've told the illustration, you could have said the point five times over, because you had to explain so much of the movie to make the point. But that's moving now to the problems of illustrations. I still want to go on what's the advantages of them. But it selects the audience, creates the audience, connects the audience, can make the one talk applicable to different audiences by changing the illustrations. Yes, the biblical illustrations have a generality about them that is magnificent. They are not as culturally bound as everyone wants to make, whereas many of our modern illustrations are very culturally bound. I mean, I may not have actually ever put my hand on a sheep in my life, but the idea of what a shepherd is and what a sheep is, I can relate to. But, you know, did you see Mad Max? Well, if you didn't, you're on the outer right now, aren't you? You've got no idea what a Mad Max is. So, I mean, just take the movie one, for example. You know, I was watching this movie the other day and it made me think of this point, right? It suddenly occurs to people out there, hey, you can think when you're in the movies. You know, there's an idea, isn't it? And you can actually analyse a movie from a Christian perspective. You can see Christian ideas and anti-Christian ideas being conveyed in movies. That's a very useful thing to communicate, even if they don't get the particular point because they didn't see that particular movie. And that's true on all things, yes. The person who can see the hand of God all the time around about them, and they know that because of the illustrations you're using, helps. I can see the Bible right in front of me here because I'm looking at the world through the eyes of the Bible. Yep, which is how we want people to be thinking. So illustrations do that for us. All right, any other purposes we have for the illustrations? Just use the word sex every now and then so as to get people back on board. Yes, there are certain illustrations which do recapture the attention, which is important to do, yes. Yeah, on the good and the bad illustrations can be the case like this. That is, I've talked about repentance and forgiveness over and over again, but I've noticed one of the things that moves people to it is when I tell them about my sin and my repentance. Now, when I tell it to them like that, they're still not very moved. But when I tell them even a silly little illustration, like the fact of the famous occasions in which I stole a book from a library, I didn't mean to, but I did. I had this book on dolphins because I was in a debate on is whaling murder. And so I went to the local library, got out this book on whales and on two books, and I returned the one on whales, and I didn't return the one on dolphins, but I didn't realise I hadn't returned it. And the library sent me a note saying I hadn't returned it, and I assured them that I had, and on their second note I rang them up and was fairly forceful on the fact that I had, and it was a mistake at their end and they should keep better records. And then a few months later I found it. If you've ever seen my study, you'd understand why a few months later I would find a book under some papers and there was some dolphins, and I felt bad about it, so I just put it aside thinking I'll take it back later. Well, putting aside a book in my library really doesn't help very much, and over the years I kind of moved it around from one pile to another, each time remembering that I was going to take it back sometime, until in the end I found it easier just to put it in the bookcases properly, and because it was untidy where it was. So I left it there for several years, you see, until my children came and found this book on dolphins and asked me why it had a library stamp inside it. And I said, well, that's because it belonged to the library, and then why did I have it? And out of the mouths of babes and infants come the praises of God and the accusations of parents. And so I had to say, well, I didn't give, and they said that they thought that was stealing, and it really was, wasn't it? And so then I had to front up to the library with this book and apologise, one, for stealing it and not returning it, and two, for accusing them of their failure to keep proper records. And, of course, by that time I had to pay the fine. Well, the fine was fairly heavy after several years of a book outstanding. And so I really had to beg for mercy from them, because the fine was actually worth many, many times more than the book was. I could have bought a whole library of books on whales and dolphins and donated it to the library just as cheaply as giving back that one. And it really was embarrassing, and it was humiliating, and it was difficult to do, and yet I could have no peace until I did it. I mean, I could. I kept on pretending it didn't matter. I kept on shoving it to this part of the library and that part of the library and put it away and cover it up. But every time my eye came across it, again, it irritated me. And once I took it back, I found that after a while, I didn't go to that library very often. Because even going to the library reminded me that I still had a book out from the library that I hadn't paid for. In fact, I didn't take any books out. In fact, it wasn't a very good library, I decided after a while. It was much easier perceiving it for what it really was, a very crummy library that didn't keep records very well. But of course, once I confronted the issue and dealt with it properly, and went forth and gave it back to them and offered to pay the rent, pay the fine, and reinstated myself as a member of the library, I found it actually was a very good collection. And there were lots of good things there to borrow. And my attitude to the library changed completely, and my attitude to my own... And you see, people are much more likely to take the action themselves when they've heard me explaining the action I've had to take in those kinds of concrete terms. Because you can hear and feel how you cover up sin, how you pretend not to sin, how your children's questioning is something you'd rather not have. How it all fits, doesn't it, as to what we are like with sin and the fact that a price has to be paid for what we have done that is wrong. And to hear that the librarian pardoned me completely from the fine, which was a great act of grace and generosity on their behalf, because they had every right to exact the fine from me. They were just glad to get the book back, of course, but they had the right. You see, that illustration I found works in preaching better than telling people about repentance and forgiveness generally. It's just more open. It also tells them all kinds of things about me, doesn't it? And connects me with them. Pity none of it's true. But it's a good yarn, isn't it? All of it's only all too true. Okay, what are the dangers of illustrations? What are the collateral damage by trying to illustrate? Lying. Yes, it's a very delicate art, this business of telling illustrations and telling the truth and telling lies. It's a very difficult thing. Every story is, of course, untrue. You can't tell a true story with absolute candor and truth, because it requires you telling everything which you can time is not long enough. You've got to select facts, and the selection is distortion. It always is there. It's just part of the... And people who tell the story so as to tell it exactly tell terribly boring stories because they give you all the unnecessary information and they miss the storyline and the punchline. There is a movie, Not Without My Daughter. Ever see that movie, Not Without My Daughter, about the woman who's in Iran, American woman, married to an Iranian man. They go to Iran for a holiday and then he decides to stay in Iran and she's to leave her child behind. It's Not Without My Daughter, Not Without My Son, or daughter. And so the woman then stays in Iran and tries to work out how to rescue her daughter out of Iran. The trouble is it's one of those movies where she wants to tell the truth. And so the movie goes for about an hour longer. I mean, in the end, you don't care whether she gets out with or without a daughter or whether she stays there forever. I was so utterly sick of her and her daughter by the time the thing finished. You know, I thought it was good riddance. And it was... The plot line was lost because of the concern for the truth. There's a movie out on Tyndale, William Tyndale, called God's Outlaw. Ripping story is William Tyndale. The book was good, but the movie followed the book carefully. And consequently, the movie, the video, I found boring. I was sick to death of Tyndale. You know, I would have lit the match by the time it got there. But movies have to be... You know, when people see movies and they come out saying it's not as good as the book, they're people who do not understand the different media that they're dealing with. Books are one thing, movies are another thing. And the level of abstraction is quite different. Well, likewise, public speaking raconteurs have to tell stories in a way that holds the audience, which means you've got to cut and snip around the truth. There's no other alternative to it. And if people believe every jot and tittle of what is being said, more fool them. They're just philistines. They haven't understood the nature of storytelling. Even though the story is fundamentally the truth and the point that you're making is true, but the story can be a distortion. Oh, yes, right, yes, that's classic. Three times the Apostle Paul's conversion is recorded in the book of Acts. But on all three occasions, it's different. And for all three occasions, it's seeking to achieve a different purpose in the argument of the book of Acts. None of it is untrue in the sense that it's contradictory. It's just the different bits are emphasised or unemphasised, and different bits are left out or brought in. And so it's there in the Bible, and it's just how you tell stories. And it's very important to know how to do it. I mean, the essence of telling a joke is all in the timing. And so the timing has got to do with your selection of how you're telling it, isn't it? And there are some people who can never tell jokes because they've just got no timing. But anyway, what else are dangers in illustrations? It is possible. You've heard that some people somewhere sometimes have had some difficulty in that they have had their illustration drive their exegesis of the Bible. Yes, it's a major problem. When you've got a really, really good illustration that you think is fantastic, drop it. Get rid of it. Your illustration has to illustrate the point, not drive the point. Yeah? Sometimes I tell jokes to help the audience. Quite often I tell jokes to help myself. And sometimes the jokes to help myself are totally inappropriately placed for the sake of the audience. And that can be disastrous, because you're quite right, it's a classic. And I remember Chepo chipping me about that years ago, because I really got the point where the audience was hanging over the edge and I thought of something funny, and so I said it. He ripped tripe out of me the next week, I tell you. Yeah. Ah, yes. Okay. Two different things here. One is the explanation of your illustration, and then building your sermon more and more on your illustration and less on the text, and then, of course, ultimately, as Pete says, interpreting the text in the light of the illustration. And then a second different thing altogether is that you give an illustration of point A, but in the process, because it is, especially if it's a long, complex illustration, the audience hears about B, C and D, and they go away forgetting the point A, which you were trying to illustrate, and taking with them B, C and D, none of which was appropriate. Take the movies one, for example. I've got this really good illustration from this movie, which... Let me pick on a movie here that I could illustrate it from, The Silencing of the Lambs, right? I've got this marvellous illustration of The Silencing of the Lambs. at this point, you see, the audience goes away saying, ah, it's all right to go and see horror movies. R-rated movies are okay. The minister goes and sees them. Now, I didn't mean to say that. I didn't mean to illustrate that. But because I chose a movie of a particular genre and kind that I really actually oppose and don't want to have, they hear the different message than the thing I'm actually illustrating. Illustrations can overwhelm the sermon, especially too many illustrations, but even powerful and really good illustrations can overwhelm the sermon. And so you can actually make the text of the Bible boring so that people only wake up and listen to the illustrations. And when you go back to saying what verse 3 says and what verse 4 says, that's when they drop off to sleep, because that's really unimportant stuff. The important stuff is the illustrations, especially if you're passionate about the illustrations and fairly kind of lackadaisical about when you speak. And I've seen it, because the illustrations are ours and we've thought them up, I've seen some preachers who really, the illustration grabs them and they are really telling it with passion, and they say, well, now let's get back to verse 3. Verse 3 is... And so you're sending the message, the Bible is unimportant, the illustration is what matters. But you can do it even without doing that kind of overtly, just by the number of illustrations, or by the power of the illustrations, or the fact that you have to have an illustration. See, one of the preachers of Sydney, who in his heyday was a great preacher, I won't mention his name, but in his heyday he certainly was, he would never start with a motivation step. The classic old teaching methodology was you start with a motivation. You set a problem for people to motivate them to want to know what's in the text of Scripture. He would say the Scriptures are the motivation step. So he'd say, today's sermon is on Hebrews chapter 8. Open up there and away you go. Rather than trying to engage people with an idea that is in Hebrews 8 that would get them interested. Because what that is saying, he argued, was Hebrews 8 is not inherently interesting. Right? Therefore, I've got to interest you in Hebrews 8. And so our very kind of methodology of teaching, our methodology of illustrations, is undermining the kind of thing we're trying to say. That is that the Scriptures themselves are what matters. Likewise, in terms of application, the Scriptures themselves give you the application. You don't always have to spell it out for people. Now, there's further dangers in the application illustration. Who can pick up what those are for me, rather than me telling you? What are the other dangers? Yeah, John? Yeah, it doesn't apply to me, doesn't apply? Huh? Yes. And it can do that too because I pick one application when the text has 1,000 or 100. There's all kinds of applications that come from this. In order to make it concrete and clear for the audience, I pick one. Now, if that one is not the one that refers to John, well, John goes home saying, well, it wasn't for me. He was just preaching to Tony that day. I'm glad Tony, hope Tony got the message, right? Or if it was actually one that is for both, they can hear it. They say, okay, I will go home and I will, from here on in, not steal stuff from the computers. You know, I will always pay... But I'll still steal from the tax man. I'll still steal on the other, because he didn't mention that. All I've got to do is worry about the computers. And for those of us, of course, that don't have computers, that's not a problem. And so we go home with the application becomes more powerful than the text. The illustration becomes more powerful than the text. So rather than kind of being a help and an aid to the communication of the text is just a kind of a resource base for very good illustrations and applications. And so there are some sermons that are just like that. Yeah? Yeah, it certainly heads in that direction, doesn't it? And people also take things absolutized. So I would use an illustration of something. I had one discussion the other day with somebody, with Jeff, that's right, about rosters. You see, I've always been opposed to rosters in churches. Jeff, of course, is always for rosters in churches. He can't believe you can run a church without a roster. But I've run a church 20-odd years without a roster. And quite a few people say that's why we're in the mess that we're in, including Jeff. Why am I against rosters? Well, because I believe all Christians are ministers and all Christians should be thinking lovingly, and therefore all Christians should take responsibility for whatever is happening in a meeting on any occasion. And we shouldn't need people to be rostered on to be doing this and rostered on, because people then do it out of a spirit of rules and regulations, and I don't have to help put out the chairs today because I'm not rostered to put on out the chairs, and I don't have to help being the usher today because I'm not rostered to be an usher. All members are ushers. All members are chair putter outers. All members are washer uppers. All members. And I want to encourage all people. Now, you see, I make that point with some vigour and emphasis to try and communicate to the congregation the idea of every member being a minister and every one of us loving each other and all owning the church, etc. But it then becomes absolutised in people's minds. Rosters in churches are evil. Any church that has a roster, you see, is actually not really biblical and has failed in the acid test of Pope Philip I. And you see, the whole thing is... It's just an illustration to try and help people. It's a concrete application to try and help people see that we are all involved in ministry and need all to be involved, need that. The point was a simple and a good point. The consequence of it can be disastrous because people mishear. That's the illustration. Yeah, what other problems are there in illustration? Richard? But yeah, some illustrations just too powerful. Just as you can draw a congregation in by the illustrations you use, you can alienate a congregation by the illustrations you use, and you can drive people away. I spoke down at a church in the Shire as a visiting speaker once. I won't mention which one it was, but as I was preaching there, it was in the days of Gough Whitlam. I know that's history for most of you, but it was current affairs. And I mentioned Whitlam by name, but I didn't even mention him negatively. I just mentioned him. That's just in passing. Just said something. A cough. A member of the congregation stormed out as soon as the hymn was over, and then during the handshake at the door, that famous third sacrament of Anglican churches, he came back in, and blackout, he really went for me, uphill and down dale. I didn't know the man from a sail, but he was just livid about how I'd attacked the Labour Party and on and on and on and on. So I took him aside and calmed him down, and I got out my notes and we discussed what I had said and said, and I helped him see that I actually had not said anything negative about the Labour Party or Gough Whitlam. And he went away a little mollified, and then he came back about half an hour later and apologised to me, and was really very broken about it. He'd been converted only about 4 or 5 years, but in those 4 or 5 years, every Sunday in that church, the Labour Party had been attacked. And he'd been a Labour Party man all his life and was a great supporter of Gough Whitlam. And he was fed up with his party being attacked from the pulpit all the time. And all I had to use the word was the word Whitlam, and he assumed from the context of where I was speaking that I would be immediately anti-Labour Party. I didn't tell him that my father was a great Jack Lang supporter. The idea that we were attacking the Labour Party was fairly strange to my ears, but he couldn't differentiate. Now, there was a man through conversion who had hung in a church he hated. How many other Labour Party people in the area, in the Shire? Well, he was the only one, of course, but how many other Labour Party people in the area were not coming back to that church? See, politics is a very dangerous thing to bring out from the pulpit. I defy any St. Matthias people to actually tell you how I vote in the elections. Right? You can sure I don't vote communist, that is true. And I haven't voted for the fascists and the Nazis, that is true. But within the broad range of the political parties, you cannot work out from what I say what I believe. I can drop you hints, like my father was a great Jack Lang supporter. I can also tell you that my uncle was the leader of Bob Menzies' upper house in the Senate. So you still don't know then, do you? In each illustration I use from the left, I try and work out how to use one from the right as well, so that no one can actually pinpoint, because I don't want to lose people and alienate people on that kind of illustration. It's just not helpful. Now, too many blokey illustrations, too many football jokes. The wrong code of football always being referred to, right, can have its effects and its negatives. I cracked jokes here yesterday about soccer and the World Cup. I don't mind about you guys. I'm not going to alienate you on soccer. That's neither here nor there. But I wouldn't actually say it from the pulpit. You know, I've got to be more careful in that context. When I was up in Malaysia last week, none of them supported rugby. And I couldn't find an Aussie rules follower in the whole church. They were all absolutely besotted with soccer. So, against my own personal instincts, I had to devise how to use soccer illustrations and not call it soccer, but call it football. You see? I mean, that's because I'm trying to actually communicate with that group of people who really need salvation so desperately. Because they're following football. Yes, I think there are two kinds of issues at stake today. For most of my lifetime, politics has been totally trivial and superficial. But now we are under the culture war where the very basis of our nation is at stake on the issues of what is life and what isn't life, what is humans and what aren't humans, what is going to be ethics and what are not going to be ethics. And they're not issues of right wing versus left wing. They're issues of whether we're going to be a Christianised country or an atheistic country. And the future of the nation and of our humanity is at stake. And so I will come out very strongly on an issue like abortion or an issue like embryonic stem cell research, because I think it raises the whole question of the nature of humanity and the nature of a humane society. And whether it happens to be the Liberal Party or happens to be the Labor Party that is promoting it is an irrelevance to me. It is a help to us. I've always found that in most of my life, we've had one party in control of New South Wales and the opposite party in control of Australia, which means you can keep praying for the Prime Minister and the Premier with an even-handedness. And that's kind of helpful, I've always thought. But that's serendipitous. Well, providential. Yes, that's right. I remember sitting next to Royal Hawks at a Billy Graham crusade. And Billy says, as the world-famous microbiologist said, and he gives the name, and Royal Hawks, who was associate professor in microbiology, said, I've never heard of him. And, you know, well, there weren't too many in the crowd who were going to be. But when you have to say someone is world-famous beforehand, it's an indication that he's not, isn't it? Right? When it says on the hoarding of the newspaper, pop star dies, you know it was nobody of any importance. If it was anybody of any importance, they'd say Madonna dies. You don't have to say pop star, do you? And so there are accuracies that you do need to maintain, and you do need to check your details and check the story, because if you're inaccurate at points, you really will annoy a small section, but you'll annoy them very profoundly. I think if you don't remember the details, but the point of the story is what you want to communicate, then you say that. I don't have a problem with that. No, I think it's helpful. That is correct. And the danger is that you think you've got to modernise it. See, very often the best illustrations are the ones in the Bible. Right? They're there, and we should. It's easy to think of things that happened to me on the way to church, but it's more important to think of what the Bible is actually teaching. And to trust the Bible to illustrate itself is very important. A lot of the Bible is fairly concrete, after all, and doesn't need it. Personally, I find the prepackaged sermon illustrations almost impossible to use. You know, there are books of dictionaries of sermon illustrations, and our American friends use them all the time, and I'm blowed if I can. I much prefer either using the Bible ones or what I saw this week. Remember Peter Watson saying years ago that he prepared the sermon on Monday, Tuesday, and then walked around all week and then wrote the sermon on Friday. And by the time Friday had come, he'd found all these illustrations during the course of the week, because his mind had been attuned from his preparation to be thinking about a subject. Once you start thinking about the subject, you see it all around about you, so that when you come to write it on Friday, you've got the illustrations, and they always have that kind of immediacy feel. They have that sense of we're dealing with this week in Sydney when we're giving them. You can see that. It's a trick, isn't it? Because come to the end now and just see. You see why I don't have a coherent theory on illustrations? It's a communication. It's a feel. How much time do I need to package what I'm going to say? How much time do I need to discover what I'm going to say? When I'm saying it, how simple is it? Well, it depends on the audience, doesn't it? One talk to one audience needs no illustration. The same talk to a different audience might need enormous amount of illustration. It's got to do with the audience rather than got to do with the talk or the speaker. And which illustrations I use is going to be affected by the different audience that I'm in. And whether this is an audience I preach to regularly or rarely. And so it's very hard to come up with a coherent theory of this is the way to illustrate. There's just practice and feedback and observation and watching the audience to see whether you're communicating or not communicating, noticing that John is wriggling and noticing that others have sat up because they see the time has come to 4 o'clock, and just seeing what is happening in the audience that you're speaking to at the time, that Tori's cold, that each of these kinds of things that you're observing with the audience means you will or will not use some illustrations at a particular time. Now, therefore, it's impossible to say, well, I haven't yet reached the point where I can write you the article on how to use illustrations. That's what I've enjoyed this afternoon, because have you noticed how many of us have contributed? Just put your hands up, all who have said something that I've taken hold of here in the course of a discussion, because it's around, Ivan, you did too several times, it's around the room that we have. It's a subject we can all feel, we can all interact on. Archie, you're going to pray before you give your announcement, or I'm going to pray and then you're going to give your announcement? Heavenly Father, we do thank you for the tremendous capacity you have given to us to use a language that is so rich and full in illustrative material. And we do pray, Father, that you would help us as we speak your word in little groups or one-to-one or in a whole congregation as we preach, wherever we may be. Help us, Father, to speak in such a way, such words of graciousness, that we might accurately and faithfully communicate the message of salvation to the hearers. Help us, Father, to analyse what we've done and what we've said and how we've said it. Help us to keep improving in our capacity for communicating to others. We do pray, Father, for your help in this regard, in Jesus' name.